Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Wednesday, August 19th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakrose. Paving a trail. Webster County Supervisors okay new trail funding. Webster County Supervisors approved an agreement that will invest nearly $1 million in county trails, appointments to the Board of Adjustment, and several large secondary roads department purchases on Tuesday. New trails. Supervisors approved a memorandum of understanding with the City of Fort Dodge, pairing and coordinating the use of grant funds from the Midas Council of Governments and the Iowa Department of Transportation to improve trails in the area. Fort Dodge was awarded a $350,000 transportation alternative grant through Midas and the Iowa DOT to construct a new trail along 170th Street, which is County Highway D-14, starting near BHJ Corporation on North 15th Street. Webster County was awarded the same amount through both entities to construct a paved trail circumnavigating Badger Lake at John F. Kennedy Memorial Park, much of which is currently gravel. The agreement approved Tuesday delegates to the city modification of the existing Regional Transportation Improvement Plan in order to allow the county to utilize the city's funding for paving the trail around Badger Lake, in addition to providing the county with up to an additional $225,000 match that was required to procure the larger grant from Midas and the Iowa DOT. The trail will be paved starting near the park's eastern entrance, providing full pavement to the campground by November 2021. The other trail from the north end of the existing nature trail near BHJ Corporation on 170th Street to the intersection of 160th Street and Oates Avenue will be called the Nature Trail Extension and is planned for completion by November 2022. With a two-year window to complete the Badger Lake Trail Loop, the Soldier Creek Trail and Kennedy Memorial Park will soon be connected by pavement for bicyclists and other recreational users, according to Matt Cosgrove, Director of Webster County Conservation. Both projects together will utilize up to $925,000 in funds. As trail pavements continue to progress in the county, Cosgrove told the Messenger that the county has a long-term vision of eventually connecting Fort Dodge to Badger with a bike trail. Board of Adjustments. Supervisors approved three applicants to fill vacancies on the Board of Adjustment for County Planning and Zoning. The vacancies were created by a new state law adopted on July 1st that started requiring all Board of Adjustment members to reside in unincorporated areas of the county. Ernest Kirsten of Fort Dodge was approved for a term expiring at the end of 2022. Kirsten is an attorney, business owner, and mineral rights owner. John Flattery of Fort Dodge was approved for a term expiring at the end of 2024. He is a farmer, realtor, and appraiser. Kent Pliner, a farmer and compliance officer for Iowa Select Farms from Otho, was approved for a term expiring at the end of 2025. Secondary Roads Purchases. The Secondary Roads Department received supervisor approval for the following purchases. A 2020 Palmer triple axle pup trailer for $62,992, an item budgeted for 2021. It was purchased from Highway Truck Equipment of Fort Dodge. A 2015 Mack semi-tractor for $46,000, replacing one involved in an accident and paid with insurance funds. It was purchased from Reese Truck and Trailer of Fort Dodge. A 2020 Mack dump truck for $129,373. It was also bought from Reese Truck and Trailer. WCPH clarifies positivity rate errors. FD Clinic's antigen test results were recorded incorrectly. The Iowa Department of Public Health is working with a local Webster County Medical Clinic to correct errors in COVID-19 test result reporting, the Webster County Public Health Department clarified in a press release on Tuesday. While reviewing the county's positivity rate last week, formulated from the sum total of individual positive cases divided by the sum total of individuals tested over a rolling 14-day period, the WCPH questioned the data that was available and why the 14-day positivity rate was high. The clinic was not named by WCPH. On Friday, the state reported positivity rate for Webster County was 23.2%. Monday evening, the department reported that errors in the coding of test results and the delayed reporting of negative results contributed to the inflated positivity rate. Antigen test results at the clinic were erroneously coded as results from the viral test or polymerase chain reaction, the WCPH said. Antigen tests are used to test for the coronavirus antibodies to determine if the individual has ever been infected with the virus. The department said the coding on those results is being corrected, and the county's confirmed positive case reports will be adjusted to reflect the accurate data. Additionally, Webster County Public Health said it reached out to the clinic and questioned if negative test results had been entered into the Iowa Disease Surveillance System database. It was reported that not all negative tests were entered, WCPH said. The local clinic submitted approximately 3,000 negative test results to IDPH that night, but later learned that the state's reporting system had rejected the submission. On Monday, the Iowa Department of Public Health validated that not all the test results had been entered into the database, which determines the county's positivity rate. Upon review, it appeared that with the increased testing in the community the week prior, the percentage of positivity had gone down, and with the additional negatives that hadn't been entered into the system, it is understood that the rate would have been impacted more in a downward trend, the WCPH explained. At the end of last week, the Fort Dodge Community School District had announced it was delaying the start of the school year by 2 weeks due to the elevated positivity rate in the county. However, after learning that the accurate data would put the positivity rate much lower, the district walked back that decision on Monday, stating that the school year will begin on August 25th as originally scheduled. As of 7 p.m. on Tuesday, the county's positivity rate is recorded as 11.5% on the state's COVID-19 website. Webster County Public Health had previously said it was working with the Iowa Department and the clinic to address the coding and reporting issues, but later clarified that it only asked the Iowa Department of Public Health for guidance and a review of the data, and that the Iowa Department is working directly with the clinic to fix the issue. The WCPH does not have the authority to override or correct testing numbers, the department said. The County Health Department will continue to review Iowa Disease Surveillance System reports and analyze testing data entered into IDSS. WCPH expects that all testing data from all Webster County clinics be reported in full and in a timely manner to allow us to complete disease investigations and isolation quarantine requirements, WCPH said on Tuesday. Charges added in attempted murder case. Williams faces two more felony charges. The man charged with attempted murder for allegedly stabbing a Fort Dodge man in the neck and back has garnered two new charges. In addition to attempted murder, Donathan Williams will face one count of willful injury causing serious injury, a Class C felony, and going armed with intent, a Class D felony. The amended trial information filed by First Assistant County Attorney Ryan Baldridge was approved by the court Friday. Williams, 41, of Fort Dodge, was arrested after police say he left a man, 39, seriously injured after a July 2nd confrontation in the Biltwell apartment building, 106 North 10th Street. Community Health Center of Fort Dodge staff reported at 10:54 a.m. the day of the stabbing that the victim came in with stab wounds to the neck and back. Police say the victim fled the crime scene after being injured to seek help from the Community Health Center. He sustained serious injuries and was transported to Unity Point Health Trinity Regional Medical Center for treatment. Video surveillance shows Williams walking with a knife involved in an apparent altercation in an apartment before leaving, then returning and chasing the victim down the hallway toward the building's fire escape. In addition to video surveillance, a very apparent trail of blood led officers to the scene of the crime. A motive for the crime has not yet been made clear, but Fort Dodge police believe it was an isolated incident. Williams pleaded not guilty to the initial attempted murder charge and remains in Webster County Jail on a $100,000 bond. Midas hosting 2020 photography contest. the Mid-Iowa Development Association Council of Governments has opened the call for submissions for its 2020 photo contest. Amateur and professional photographers alike are invited to submit their best and most creative photos, showcasing their communities as wonderful places to live, work, and play. Residents of the Midas Council of Governments region are eligible to participate. This includes Calhoun, Hamilton, Humboldt, Pocahontas, Webster, and Wright counties. This is the first time Midas has held a photography contest. We don't have any stock photos of our communities, so we thought that this would be a great way to get a cache of pictures that we can use in marketing materials, said Kathy Fifner, Midas Executive Director. The contest is open from now through 5 p.m. September 28th. Midas is asking for photo entries for four categories: our hometown, arts and education, scenic landscapes, and recreation, tourism, and transit. We'd like to get anything that highlights the region or our local communities, Fifner said. We definitely are looking for pictures of downtown areas, particularly interesting perspectives of downtown. Also anything that is of interest to the region, like local businesses. Fifner said that although Midas operates the two transit systems in the region, Dodger Area Rapid Transit and the Region 5 Transit System, the organization doesn't have many good photos of its buses. Each entrant can submit up to two photos per category for a maximum of eight photos. Photos must have been taken within the past 2 years. Photos with any identifiable persons will need to have a signed consent form included with the submission. An example of the consent form can be requested from the Midas office by calling 515-576-7183. Photos from both digital cameras and high-resolution smartphones will be accepted, and photos may not be edited using a filter. There is no age requirement to submit entries for the contest. We're going to do a press release when we pick the winners, and hopefully we've got some amateur photographers out there who we'd like to see compete, and it would be a fun exercise for them, and it would give us some art that we desperately need, Fifner said. Entries will be judged on creativity, composition, impression, and overall artistic merit as it relates to each category. The winner of each category will receive a $25 Casey's gift card. Submitted photos will be used for a variety of promotional and marketing materials for the Midas region, Fifner said. The best ones we want to get mounted and posted in our office as decoration, so that we are constantly reminded of the reason why we're here, she said. Entries should be emailed to K. Fifner, and that's K-P as in Paul, F-I-F-F-N-E-R at MidasCog, that's M-I-D-A-S-C-O-G .net, with Midas Photo Contest Submission - your name / category written in the subject line. Otho Citywide Garage Sales this weekend. Bargain shoppers and those searching for hidden treasures will have the opportunity to peruse at least a dozen different garage sales in Otho on Saturday. Typically, the town's citywide garage sales are held over Mother's Day weekend in May, but concerns over COVID-19 forced the Otho Betterment Committee to postpone them. Missy Ewing, president of the Otho Betterment Committee, said most years as many as 15 Otho households sign up with the committee to be included in the garage sales list. So far, she said, 13 residents have signed up. Residents won't have to pay for a permit for their garage sales, but the Otho Betterment Committee does ask for a $5 donation from those who choose to sign up to be included on the list and map to cover the costs of the maps and advertising. The Otho Citywide Garage Sales will officially run from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Saturday, but Ewing said some are planning on running on Friday as well. Maps will be available of the registered garage sales at the Otho Convenience Store, 210 North Highway Street. Ewing said it is up to the individual garage sale hosts to request or require shoppers and browsers to wear masks or face coverings. Households do not have to sign up or be included in the list and map to hold a garage sale over this weekend. For more information about the Otho Citywide Garage Sales, visit facebook.com/Otho-Betterment-Committee. To sign up to be included on the list of garage sales, call Ewing at 515-829-0561. A news brief. Drive-through flu shot clinic to be offered September 12th. A drive-through flu shot clinic will be held from 9 to 11 a.m. September 12th at Webster County Public Health, 723 First Avenue South in Fort Dodge. Cost is $25, with most insurance being accepted. Call 515-573-4107 with any questions. An editorial. Schools, students need substitute teachers. Need is great, but so are opportunities. Teachers, just like every other adult in the workforce, have to take sick days on occasion. In most workplaces, everyone pulls together to cover for a coworker who's out sick, but education is different. The relationship between students and teachers is so vital to educational success that another teacher just can't look in on a sick colleague's students a couple times a day. The students need a teacher in the classroom all day. That's why there are substitute teachers to step in when a regular teacher is ill. Recruiting and retaining substitute teachers is tough. The COVID-19 pandemic just made it tougher. In response, Governor Kim Reynolds has modified the requirements for becoming a substitute teacher. Perhaps the most notable change is to the educational requirements a prospective substitute must meet. Under the governor's proclamation, substitute teachers no longer have to have a bachelor's degree. Instead, they can have an associate degree or have completed 60 hours through a regionally accredited institution. Holders of a career or technical authorization with at least 1 year of experience may also serve as substitutes. Prospective substitute teachers must complete the substitute authorization training course offered by area agencies on education. The Prairie Lakes Area Education Agency serves the Fort Dodge region. The proclamation also makes changes to the amount of time a substitute can serve. These changes are not permanent. They are for the duration of the COVID-19 emergency. These changes open up the opportunity for more people to become substitute teachers, and there's no doubt the demand for substitutes is real. By becoming a substitute teacher, a person can help to shape the lives of many young people. Becoming a substitute teacher could also launch a productive career in education. We encourage anyone who has ever contemplated a career in education to seriously consider becoming a substitute teacher now. Memorable experience. Allstate or Schnetzer shattered records, but unique bond meant more. Logan Schnetzer shattered records and molded herself into a first-team All-State softball player during her Fort Dodge career. The victories, statistics, and accolades aren't what she'll miss most about being a Dodger. "I'm definitely sad because the bond I had with those girls will never be broken," Schnetzer said of her teammates. "I'm beyond proud, though. Words couldn't even describe it. Everyone gave it their all throughout our shortened season. We handled every situation to the best of our ability. I couldn't have asked for anything more." Fort Dodge reached new heights in finishing as the Class 5A state runner-up. The Dodgers were 28-4 overall and went wire to wire as the state's number one squad before losing in the championship contest to second-rated Cedar Rapids Kennedy at Rogers Park. "I don't know what I can really say. We lost to an incredible team. I'm still proud of what we accomplished. Reaching the finals was something that I really wanted to accomplish for my senior season as a Dodger. No FDSH team had ever advanced past the semifinal round." Schnetzer established a new single-season home run record a year ago, and this summer took over the school's career mark as well. The first baseman batted .476 and led all of 5A with 46 RBIs. She was also in the top 10 for home runs with 9 and total bases with 77. For her career, Schnetzer finished with 34 homers, 167 RBIs, and spent 4 consecutive seasons above a .350 average at the plate. Fort Dodge posted a combined record of 99-19 with 3 state tournament berths in Schnetzer's final 3 years of varsity ball. "Being a Dodger shaped me into the person I am today," Schnetzer said. "This softball program, Coach Andy Adams, and all of my teachers taught me so many lessons in life. I can't thank them enough. I learned that you never have a next time or next year. You need to live in the moment and put your full effort into everything you do. I couldn't repay Coach Adams for everything she's done for me, from coaching me in softball to being the best second mama ever. I'm extremely grateful for the experience I had as a Dodger. Schnetzer will play for new Iowa Central head coach Bo Cheban and the Tritons this coming season. One of Cheban's assistants is Schnetzer's father, Dale. Time out with Logan Schnetzer. Vacation destination, Puerto Rico. People I would like to have dinner with: my mother, her fiancé, my dad, my sister, and my brother. It would surprise people that I use ketchup on most of my food. My sports role model, Mariano Rivera. My everyday role model, my mom and dad. I can't go a day without seeing my parents. Nickname, Loggy Bear. Superstition, bird poop brings good luck. Most heated rivalry, Valley and Waukee. Favorite road trip, driving to Florida with my sister. What are you listening to right now? The Sinister Movie. Favorite team, 2020 Dodger softball. Favorite movie, Bridesmaids. Favorite magazine, People. Favorite phone app, Snapchat. Miller fondly remembers first Dodger assistant. Atkins, who spent 6 years in FD as a teacher and coach, passes away. John Atkins Jr., Don Miller's first assistant during his formative days as the Fort Dodge Senior High wrestling coach, died last week in his home state of Wyoming. He was 76. Atkins was recruited to Fort Dodge by Miller after the pair were collegiate teammates at the University of Wyoming. For 6 years, Atkins served on Miller's staff and as a sophomore football coach while teaching mathematics at FDSH. Miller met Atkins when he arrived at UW in 1964. "I was a freshman and he was a junior," said Miller, who eventually became a program captain, a three-time Western Athletic Conference champion, and an All-American in 1968. "We became friends very quickly. John was from Cheyenne originally and obviously knew the lay of the land well, which helped an Iowa farm kid from Vincent like myself with the transition." Miller returned to Central Iowa after graduating from Wyoming with a bachelor's degree in education. He became the Dodgers leader in 1970 at the age of 24. "When I finished my collegiate wrestling career, I came back home and coached at Eagle Grove in Hampton," said Miller, who was inducted into the Wyoming Athletics Hall of Fame 5 years ago. "I got the Fort Dodge job in 1970. Then athletic director Dutch Huseman asked me if I had anyone in mind for the assistant position. I didn't have a lot of contacts at the time, and John was teaching and coaching in Buffalo, Wyoming. I took a shot in the dark and gave him a call. I was very fortunate that he agreed to come. He rented the house next to ours on Cooper Drive. I was proud of the 6 years we had together. The program needed a lot of elbow grease when we took over. By his last season here, we were conference and district champs and a state runner-up in 1975-76. We added a second assistant in Jerry Einwalter. We needed to get the community to buy into the program again and rally around it. John was a big factor in that rebuilding project. He was a dear friend. Atkins, who also obtained a master's degree in animal science from Colorado State University, went west to Colorado after the 76 season. He owned a trucking company and ranched in Carr, Colorado, and also worked for Williams Production in Gillette. Atkins then moved back to Cheyenne in 2014. We kept in very close contact through the years and saw John and Bonnie, Atkins' wife, every time we visited Wyoming, Miller said. He was at the Wyoming Hall of Fame banquet when I was inducted, which meant a great deal to me. He was a good man, and he developed a strong relationship with the kids at FDSH while he was here. He was fiercely loyal. Atkins is survived by his wife, Bonnie, son Chet Atkins and spouse Jill, daughter Jana Reynolds and spouse Frank, grandson Garrett Goggin and spouse Josie, granddaughters Sean Cape and spouse Glenn and Corinda Shelby Atkins and Haley Atkins, and two great-grandsons, Monty and Bohannon Goggin. Eagle Grove grad Kylie promoted. Garrett Kylie has been promoted to lead assistant wrestling coach at the University of Northern Colorado, head coach Troy Nickerson announced recently. Kylie, a graduate of Eagle Grove, joined the staff at Northern Colorado in 2018 and has helped the Bears advance 8 wrestlers in the Division I NCAA championships and sign a top 5 recruiting class. "I'm very grateful for this promotion and opportunity," Kylie said. "It's been a pleasure to learn and grow under Coach Nickerson in my first 2 seasons at UNC. Having your efforts and contributions recognized is always a great feeling. Our staff works very well together, and I'm committed to helping UNC climb to new heights in the Big 12 Conference and NCAA. In his first season on the Northern Colorado staff, Kylie helped coach 3 wrestlers to the NCAA championships. He also helped recruit 2 future NCAA qualifiers in Andrew Aliris and Moshe Schwartz. Under his guidance, 5 Bear wrestlers have become NWCA Scholar All-Americans, and Rico Montoya was named the Big 12 Wrestling Scholar Athlete of the Year. Coach Kylie has grown to become an integral part of our wrestling program, and his abilities have proven to be superior," Nickerson said. "He is committed to being with us for the long haul and is very deserving of the title change. I look forward to him continuing to push me and the program to new heights." Northern Colorado qualified 5 individuals for the NCAA championships last year before the event was canceled because of the coronavirus pandemic. Prior to joining the Bears, Kylie coached for 2 seasons at Campbell University, qualifying 7 wrestlers for the NCAA championships. He also spent time as the Iowa State Director of Operations, working with Nickerson. He has also made stops at Concordia University and Wayland Baptist University. Kylie graduated from Simpson College in 2008 with a Bachelor of Arts degree in physical education and earned his Master of Arts in Coaching and Athletic Administration from Concordia University, Irvine. Marion Home clears COVID-19 outbreak. Official: 5 residents tested positive but are asymptomatic and are now removed from isolation. Recently discovered information from the Iowa Department of Public Health shows that the Marion Home became the first nursing home in Webster County to have a COVID-19 outbreak, 1 of 32 in the state. Marion Home Administrator Tracy Trotter said Tuesday that 5 residents who were asymptomatic and identified through precautionary surveillance testing tested positive for COVID-19 starting July 29th. Trotter said that the number of cases there reported by the IDPH, 8, is incorrect. An outbreak in state data is defined as 3 or more cases. The outbreak identified in state data was not publicly identified by the Marion Home or Webster County Public Health, which have no legal obligation to announce outbreaks of the novel coronavirus. After the first case, 3 more were identified on July 31st, as well as 1 on August 5th. All have recovered and have been removed from isolation as of Monday. In addition to screening employees at the beginning and end of every shift, the Marion Home conducts weekly testing on all employees and residents to catch infections early before they spread. The nursing home has 67 residents and approximately 119 employees. State data indicates that 941 long-term care facility residents have tested positive for COVID-19. Of those residents, 525, or 60%, have died. Nursing home deaths have accounted for more than half of Iowa's death toll, which fell just short of 1,000 on Tuesday. You are listening to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Wednesday, August 19th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Betty Jane Garber. Betty Jane Garber, 90, went to be with the Lord peacefully on August 16th at Pleasant View Home in Kelowna. She was born on August 15th, 1930, in Canton, Ohio, to Ernest and Beulah Gibson Miller. She was united in marriage to C. Irvin Garber in 1949. They moved together to Manson, where they raised 6 biological children and became guardians of 3 additional children in 1963. Betty was a beloved homemaker and was very active in the Mennonite Church as a youth leader, Sunday school teacher, and played piano and organ. She loved visits from family, reading, and doing crossword puzzles. She spent her retirement years in both Fort Dodge and Sarasota, Florida. She was dearly loved by all. Larson Weishauer Funeral Home is handling the arrangements, and a full obituary is available on their site. Melvin Ramsden. Melvin L. Ramsden, 78, formerly of Fort Dodge, died July 29th in Palm Springs, California. He is survived by his wife, Jean, children, Kurt, Christy, and Jamie, stepchildren, Cameron and Danon, and five grandchildren. Alfred D. Klingson. Alfred D. Klingson, 87, passed away Tuesday, August 18th at his home. Funeral services are pending at the Palmer Funeral Home in Gowrie. To protect and serve, Trevor Michelle, Deputy, Webster County Sheriff's Office. Question, how long have you been in law enforcement? Answer, I have been in law enforcement for a total of 17 years. Question, what other law enforcement positions or departments have you served in? Answer, before becoming a deputy sheriff for Webster County, I was a police officer for the Okoboji Police Department. While there, I was on the multi-Iowa-Minnesota SWAT team called HEAT, which stands for High Risk Entry Arrest Team, and on the Northwest Iowa Drug Task Force. Prior to that, I was acting sergeant for Webster City Police Department, but started my career out as a reserve deputy for Webster County and reserve police officer for Gowrie Police Department. Question, what's an interesting fact about you that some might not know? Answer, an interesting fact that others may not know about me is I have a substantial history of a martial arts background where I have trained in taekwondo, kickboxing, taijutsu, and muay thai, which is Thai boxing. Question, what's the most memorable incident you've responded to? Answer, with the amount of calls we deal with on a regular basis, they all are memorable in their own little way and stick with us for the rest of our lives. But there is one that is most memorable for me, and that was responding to a welfare check on a young man that I found unresponsive with the result of a self-inflicted injury. Question, what's the best part of your day? Answer, the best part of my day is being able to make it back home to my family and walking through the front door to the open arms of my daughter. Question, what gives you the most satisfaction in your job? Answer, what gives me the most satisfaction of my job is being able to put the uniform on and go out and do the best of my ability to make positive impacts to the citizens of Webster County that I so proudly serve. Question, what's the toughest part about your job? Answer, there are so many things we deal with that make our jobs tough, but I believe one of the toughest is responding to a kind of call where you do your best and have to save the person and were unable to do so, then follow with that by having to go tell their loved ones that they are not coming home. An editorial from Rich Lowry. Post Office Paranoia. At this rate, Postmaster General Louis DeJoy will be lucky if he isn't arrested and tried for treason before a people's tribunal. DeJoy has quickly replaced Vladimir Putin as the man that progressive opinion will hold responsible if President Donald Trump wins a second term in November. According to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, DeJoy is a complicit crony aiding Trump's efforts to sabotage American democracy. She believes the two have hatched a plot to delay mail-in voting and disenfranchise countless Americans prior to the election. Protesters over the weekend showed up at DeJoy's Washington, D.C. apartment and North Carolina home. Two Democratic congressmen have called for a criminal inquiry into DeJoy's changes at the Postal Service, and he will testify at a House hearing next week. In tried and true fashion, President Trump has stoked suspicions by saying that he opposes a $25 billion Postal Service bailout in the latest Democratic COVID-19 relief bill. According to Trump, blocking this measure and $3 billion in election aid to the states will prevent universal mail-in voting. But the bailout doesn't have anything to do with mail-in voting, and given the billions of pieces of mail handled by the post office every week, it surely can handle the increased volume from mail-in voting. It is true that Postmaster General DeJoy is a major Trump donor. He made his fortune in shipping and logistics, though, and he was selected by the Postal Service's Board of Governors. Little did he know when he took over the agency in June that he'd soon have a starring role in the country's latest psychodrama. Every change at the Postal Service is now seen through the prism of a belief that the agency is a tool of creeping authoritarianism. letter collection boxes are being removed. Never mind that this has been an ongoing process for years. Underutilized boxes are decommissioned or moved to higher traffic areas. In 2009, the Washington Post reported that 200,000 boxes had been shelved over the past two decades. In 2016, the Inspector General noted that another 12,000 collection boxes had been cut over the previous 5 years. Letter collection boxes all of a sudden have big red locks on them. Well, yeah, as an off-hours device to prevent the theft of mail, also something the Postal Service has done for years. The Postal Service is deactivating mail sorting machines. Right, and there was a plan for this prior to DeJoy becoming Postmaster General, and it has long been discussed in response to the declining volume of mail. DeJoy is cutting back on overtime. Indeed, he is, because artificially swollen overtime is an enormous expense that he hopes to eliminate with a more rational delivery system. Democrats and much of the media make it sound as though the post office was an efficient, smooth-running agency before DeJoy took charge and then, at Trump's behest, transformed it into a place struggling to keep up with broad-based changes in how we communicate. In reality, the post office has lost nearly $80 billion since 2007, and it lost more than $2 billion last quarter. Unless the service finds a way to innovate, it is headed for bankruptcy. This is the impetus for DeJoy's reforms, which should be welcomed by all the people now caterwauling about how essential the post office is to the American way of life. DeJoy has been adamant that the Postal Service will do its job regarding mail-in ballots. The post office's recent warnings to states that they should be mindful of how quickly ballots can be delivered were played up as yet another assault on mail-in balloting. To the contrary, they were intended to avoid unrealistically late deadlines for mail-in voting that could create a train wreck in November. But in their inflamed state, Democrats want a villain. If not a foreign potentate, then the guy in charge of delivering the mail. Trump promises storm recovery aid. Kim Ream recounted Tuesday how the unusually powerful storm that tore through Iowa last week destroyed her Cedar Rapids home and laid waste to more than 100 large trees on her property. During a briefing at the airport in Iowa's second largest city, Ream, who leads a local homeless shelter, told President Donald Trump that it would cost roughly $250,000 to clear the trees from her land because that damage wasn't covered by insurance, leading Trump to express surprise. Ream said the people staying at her Mission of Hope shelter are hungry for compassion from our leaders, just to know our leaders care. And she said people are generally worn down by the coronavirus pandemic that left many without work. Some had just returned to their jobs, only to be idled again by the August 10th storm. We're strong and resilient, Mr. President, but we are tired and we need your help, she said. 8 days after the storm, a rare derecho, raked the state with hurricane-strength winds, thousands are still picking through the pieces of broken homes and hauling fallen trees and other debris from their properties. About 40,000 customers still don't have power, and a group of African refugees was living in tents outside of their decimated apartment building, initially refusing to leave, despite the pleas of human services workers. Cedar Rapids, which is in eastern Iowa, was hardest hit and drew the attention of Trump, who promised to approve a request for $180 million in aid for damaged homes and infrastructure in the state. He also promised additional funding for farmers who were affected by an unusually powerful storm that tore through the state last week. On Monday, Trump signed a portion of Republican Governor Kim Reynolds' disaster relief request that covers extensive debris removal and repairs to public buildings, streets, and bridges in 16 counties. That portion of the request totaled about $45 million. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, however, is still assessing the governor's individual assistance request, which includes $100 million in damage to private utilities and $82.7 million in damage to homes, according to early state estimates. In addition, farmers sustained an estimated $2.7 billion in damage to crops, grain storage, and buildings, which is part of the declaration and would likely be covered under various U.S. Department of Agriculture programs. The individual assistance request covers 27 counties. Trump indicated Monday that he had signed the state's disaster aid request in full, but he had not approved the individual assistance, which makes up the largest portion of the $3.99 billion aid request. Reynolds on Monday thanked Trump for his approval, but didn't acknowledge that the bulk of the state's request was pending. The partial funding approval was later acknowledged during Tuesday's meeting. The governor's spokesman didn't respond to a message seeking comment. Trump angling for votes with immigration talk. Promises pardon for Susan B. Anthony. Grappling for votes and the spotlight as Democrats hold their national convention, President Donald Trump targeted voters in key states and constituencies Tuesday and promised a pardon for Susan B. Anthony, a leader in the women's suffrage movement. Trump headed for Arizona, one of the top 2020 battleground states, to press his case against his Democratic challenger, Joe Biden, painting him as radically left and out of the political mainstream. With his second trip in 2 days, Trump was hoping to mitigate a convention polling bump for his rival and to shore up support less than 80 days from Election Day by contrasting his position with Biden's on immigration, one of the most important issues to his political base. He was also trying to staunch an erosion in support among female voters with a symbolic nod on the centennial of the ratification of the 19th Amendment. In recent weeks, Trump has been trying to build support within the pivotal female voter constituency and has stepped up his events aimed at women. His campaign has launched a Women for Trump bus tour, and the president has embraced a law and order message with renewed vigor. The president worked in a last-minute stop in Cedar Rapids for a briefing about damage from the derecho last week that has left thousands without power and caused catastrophic damage across the battleground state. Many there have expressed outrage that their plight has not received more national attention. The storm, which packed 100-mile-per-hour winds and similar power to an inland hurricane, swept across the Midwest last week, blowing over trees, flipping vehicles, and causing widespread damage. "We've come through for you, and we will always come through for Iowa," Trump said, as the city's mayor urged him to consider enhanced federal disaster funding for people there. Trump aimed to highlight his immigration agenda in Yuma, Arizona, and receive an update on construction of his southern border wall, making his second trip to the city in less than a month. It was an effort to highlight his work to deliver on a key 2016 campaign pledge. Before leaving, Trump held a White House event to announce the pardon of Anthony, convicted of voting in 1872 in violation of laws permitting only men to vote. But he quickly pivoted to the upcoming election and the issue of voting by mail. "Win, lose, or draw, we have to get it right," Trump said of the November vote count, leveling a fresh offensive against mail-in voting. "You can't have millions and millions of ballots sent all over the place, sent to people that are dead, sent to dogs, cats, sent everywhere," Trump said. In fact, voter fraud has proved exceedingly rare. The Brennan Center for Justice in 2017 ranked the risk of ballot fraud at 0.00004% to 0.0009% based on studies of past elections. Only 9 states have plans for universal mail-in voting, in which ballots are sent automatically to registered voters. 5 of those states relied on mail-in ballots even before the coronavirus pandemic raised concerns about voting in person. Trump's pardon announcement came on the 100th anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, which ensured women the right to vote. The amendment states, "The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex." Congress passed it in 1919, and the amendment was ratified on August 18, 1920. Anthony was arrested for voting in Rochester, New York, and convicted in a widely publicized trial. Although she refused to pay the fine, the authorities declined to take further action. She felt the trial was the greatest miscarriage of justice because she had not had an opportunity to have a jury of her peers, and the jury didn't get to vote, according to Deborah L. Hughes, president and CEO of the National Susan B. Anthony Museum and House in Rochester, where Anthony died in 1906. "So to pardon her is to validate the trial, and she would not buy that idea at all," Hughes said. Hughes said the question to ask on the anniversary is how she would want to be honored. She would be the first to say, if any president wanted to honor her, the best way to do that is to make sure there is no voter suppression anywhere in the United States, Hughes said. Illinois woman killed in Mississippi River boat crash in Iowa. Authorities in eastern Iowa are seeking information on a boat crash in the Mississippi River near LeClaire that killed an Illinois woman. The collision of a large black center console boat and a blue and white 19-foot ski boat on the river happened Sunday evening, the Iowa Department of Natural Resources said in a news release. The crash killed Dr. Anita Pink, 52, of Moline, Illinois, an obstetrician and gynecologist with the group Obstetrics and Gynecology Specialists in Davenport, according to a statement from the clinic. A 61-year-old man in the same boat with Pink also suffered critical injuries in the crash, investigators said. A woman in the other boat suffered minor injuries. Pink delivered more than 2,000 babies during her 19-year practice in Davenport, according to the clinic's website. She also served as medical director for the clinic's sister company, Revive, at the Group Medical Spa, and was a mother of four. The State Natural Resources Department has asked that anyone who witnessed the crash or has information on it to contact the department. Iowa State audit finds evidence of malfeasance in Cloutier. A special investigation into concerns of malfeasance in the east central city of Cloutier turned up more than $100,000 in improper and unsupported spending of public money and undeposited collections, state officials said. State Auditor Rob Sand said in a new report that the audit looked at the handling of city finances by former city clerk Carrie Copriva from 2015 through the beginning of 2019. The investigation found $64,530 in improper disbursements, $9,209 in unsupported disbursements, and $43,450 in undeposited utility collections. The report found much of the misspending included direct payments to Copriva and unauthorized purchases on the city's credit card. The more than $43,000 in undeposited utility collections is an estimate garnered by comparing the average cash utility collections deposited during Copriva's tenure to the average deposited after her employment, Sand said. Copies of the report were filed with the Tama County Sheriff's Office, the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation, the Tama County Attorney's Office, and the Iowa Attorney General's Office, Sand said. A publicly listed telephone number for Copriva was no longer in service Tuesday, and she could not be reached for comment. Stranded hiker survives after 2 weeks in Santa Fe Forest. A father and his two children, while out hiking, helped rescue a man who was stranded in the Santa Fe, New Mexico National Forest for 14 days. John Utsi launched an unexpected 2-day rescue mission Saturday after hearing a call for help while hiking with his kids up to Windsor Trail toward the Santa Fe Baldy, KRQE-TV reported. "I'm not sure he had more than a day or two left," said Utsi, who was the first to find the hiker in distress. Utsi heard his voice after calling for his daughter, who walked up the trail and out of sight. He immediately began searching for the man, who was found 20 minutes later and about 600 yards off the trail down a steep hillside. The man was lying beside a creek. He couldn't move and was delirious, Utsi said. His lips were all chapped to the point they were bleeding. His tongue was swollen. He was super gaunt and skinny. I was like, this guy really needs help. Utsi and his kids gave the man all of the food and water they had before hiking back to the trailhead to call 911. Santa Fe firefighters arrived within the hour, but could not find the hiker and called off the search after 8 hours. Utsi went back out to the spot Sunday at 9 a.m. and found the hiker in the same spot. He then called 911 again and waited until around 4 p.m. for crews to arrive. He then led two separate groups to the man. "Never had we found somebody who had been out for that long," Fire Captain Nathan Garcia said. "I don't think he had very much left in him. He seemed kind of at the end when we did actually encounter him." Garcia said the man, who is older than 50, was an experienced hiker but hurt his back. He went more than a week without food. He is recovering at a local hospital. Biden's convention focus, experience to fix Trump's chaos. Joe Biden is drawing on party elders at the Democratic National Convention, making the case that he and his party are uniquely positioned with experience and expertise to repair chaos that President Donald Trump has created at home and abroad. He's also showing off younger Democrats the party hopes will be the political stars of tomorrow. Former President Bill Clinton and former Secretary of State John Kerry are among the heavy hitters on a schedule that emphasizes a simple theme: leadership matters. Former President Jimmy Carter, now 95 years old, will also make an appearance. Donald Trump says we're leading the world. Well, we are the only major industrial economy to have its unemployment rate triple, Clinton says in excerpts of his remarks released ahead of the convention's second night. At a time like this, the Oval Office should be a command center. Instead, it's a storm center. There's only chaos. On a night that Biden will formally earn his party's presidential nomination, the convention will also introduce his wife, Jill Biden, to the nation as the prospective First Lady. Suffrage anniversary events highlight racial divide. As the U.S. marks the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage, many event organizers, mindful that the 19th Amendment originally benefited mostly white women, have been careful to present it as a commemoration, not a celebration. The amendment to the U.S. Constitution was ratified on August 18, 1920, but many women of color were prevented from casting ballots for decades afterward because of poll taxes, literacy tests, overt racism, intimidation, and laws that prevented the grandchildren of slaves from voting. Much of that didn't change until the Voting Rights Act of 1965. From exhibits inside the Arizona Capitol Museum to a gathering on the North Carolina Statehouse lawn, many commemorations, including those that moved online because of the coronavirus pandemic, have highlighted a more nuanced history of the American women's suffrage movement, alongside the traditional tributes to well-known suffragists such as Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. The 100th anniversary has arrived during a year of nationwide protests against racial inequality that have forced the United States to once again reckon with its uncomfortable history. Like many movements, the stories are complicated, and I think it's important, as we have an opportunity to reflect and to celebrate, that we also are honest about how we didn't meet all of our aspirations, said Rhode Island Secretary of State Nelly Gorbea, a Democrat born and raised in Puerto Rico who has helped to organize her state's suffrage commemoration efforts. It's important to have these conversations so we can do a better job going forward. The Connecticut Historical Society last month unveiled an online exhibit titled "The Work Must Be Done: Women of Color and the Right to Vote." It highlights Black women from Connecticut who fought for suffrage rights as well as other issues such as anti-discrimination, anti-lynching, labor reforms, and access to education. "We have really been wanting to make sure we talk about the complicated history of these issues in our country," said Arizona Assistant Secretary of State Allie Bones, whose office came up with a program after working with about 60 community groups across the state, many of which were very focused on not calling it a celebration but a commemoration. The complicated nature of the suffrage movement came full circle last week when Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden chose California U.S. Senator Kamala Harris as his running mate, making her the first Black woman on a major party ticket. In an appearance with Biden last week, Harris said she was mindful of all the heroic and ambitious women before me whose sacrifice, determination, and resilience makes my presence here today even possible. While their names are not as well known as the white suffragists, Black women played both prominent and smaller roles in the movement. Sojourner Truth, an emancipated slave who died in 1883, is considered one of the first Black suffragists. She traveled throughout the U.S., speaking at women's rights conventions and suffrage events, including at the Akron, Ohio Women's Convention in 1851, where she was credited with giving a powerful speech that's been remembered as, "Ain't I a Woman?" Some historians, however, have questioned the wording. Through the years, there have been many prominent Black abolitionists and suffragists who worked in their own women's clubs and suffrage organizations, and sometimes side by side with white suffragists, often working for both voting rights and civil rights. The young founding members of the Delta Sigma Theta sorority participated in the 1913 suffrage movement or suffrage march in Washington in their first public act. The Howard University students took great personal risk and were not being welcomed by some white suffragists who ultimately insisted the Black women march at the end of the procession, said Cheryl A. Hickman, National First Vice President of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, Inc. They felt that it was their obligation, if you will, even though it was unsafe, to march with the other women and show their dissension and feelings, said Hickman, whose organization has been working with organizers of the Turning Point Suffragist Memorial that's being constructed in southern Fairfax County, Virginia, and includes an overview of the entire movement, including black suffragists. The 100th anniversary marks an opportunity to honestly examine the relationship between white and black women in the women's movement, said Janetta Betch Cole, a former college president and anthropologist who is currently the national chair of the National Conference of Negro Women, an organization that was founded in 1935 to advocate for women's rights. There is more acknowledgement of the complexities of the strains of the racism in the suffrage movement than ever before, Betch Cole said. Unfortunately, one can be virtuous in one form of oppression and turn around and victimize others on another basis. In June, protesters in Iowa demanded that Iowa State University remove the name of suffragist and alumna Carrie Chapman Catt from a building because of white supremacist and anti-immigrant statements attributed to her. Doris Kelly, a former Democratic Iowa House representative who chairs the state's 19th Amendment Centennial Commemoration, said it's important to remember the historic context that suffragists navigated while acknowledging the movement's complexities. The logo of Iowa's Centennial Commemoration, hard won, not done, Kelly said, is a nod to that unfinished history. And that does it for today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Wednesday, August 19th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.